As lead singer and songwriter of the Kinks, Ray Davis has influenced countless musicians, including The Who, Van Halen, and The Pretenders. His songs have such irrepressible vitality that at just the mention of titles like You Really Got Me, All Day and All Night, Lola, or Victoria, you immediately hear them in your mind. Ray Davis has been a guest on the show a number of times, but this time he's here to talk about his memoir that explores from the perspective of a Brit what America has meant to him as an artist. It's called Americana. It's just been published by Sterling, and I'm delighted that it has brought Ray Davis back to our show today. Hello.
Well put.
And before we begin, can we clear up the pronunciation of your last name?
Because you pronounce it correctly.
Well, I'm almost sure to get some corrections from listeners to say, you idiot, it's Davies, Davies.
No, it's Davis. Davis is good.
What were your impressions of America when you were growing up in post-war northern London? Had that area been hit hard by the Blitz?
Well, yes. Well, we moved out, my family, from the inner city, King's Cross, the railway terminals. And railways figure quite prominently in my life, as anyone who reads the books will discover. They left the battered inner city to move out to a more sedate green belt area, a few miles up the road called Finchley and Muswell Hill, N2 and Highgate. And in fact, I live about 2 miles from where I was born. So I've always hovered around North London area.
Although it's become more gentrified in recent years.
Well, not my house.
So when you, were you one of those people who just fell in love with the United States? When I lived in London in 1960, I was made aware that not everyone loved American culture. Some people thought it had come to be too dominating.
Well, see, I came from a large family, and my sisters took me to the cinema. So I think mainly through the cinema that I first made contact with America. You know, Tom Mix, Saturday Morning Pictures, Roy Rogers, and people like that.
And so you want to be a cowboy?
Well, they were the superheroes of my youth. And remember, I remember being having rationing until I was about 5 or 6 years old in the mid-50s. Mm. So it was a glamorous antidote to the world that we lived in.
You write that music came to liberate you. What kinds of music, and how did it liberate you?
Well, there's a man called John Grierson who virtually invented the documentary. And he had a program on television called This Wonderful World, where he showed clips from around the world. And one night he showed a clip of a man called Big Bill Brunzi, who was from Mississippi and made his name in Chicago as a blues man. He played this incredible footage shot, I think, in Belgium, a documentary of Brunzi playing two of his songs. And I was riveted by it, inspired by it. And that really is the trigger that made me want to take up playing the guitar.
But you didn't have as much access to American music as people did in other countries because the BBC wasn't playing it. You had to listen to Radio Luxembourg, didn't you?
Radio Luxembourg was an offshore station. And with varying degrees of reception, we used to listen to it. There was a program called Jazz Club on the BBC, but it was sort of mainly mainstream jazz.
Humphrey Littleton,
George Melly, people like that. And when I first heard Brunzi, of course we wanted to play R&B music. Then later on through Radio Luxembourg, and then eventually the BBC. We heard blues music, Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf. Howlin' Wolf appeared on Jazz Club. He did a song called Tupelo, Mississippi. And it really inspired me and my brother to make R&B records. Then, of course, pop came along, rock and roll, Bill Haley. So the music got its hooks into me. And country music, I loved Hank Williams when I was a kid. So it just evolved from there.
Was this partly because your father liked that kind of music?
He played a bad Dixieland banjo, and all I got 6 older sisters, and they all played the piano very badly, but varying degrees of competence. But it was a musical our household.
But you said that your father was more of a rock and roller than you were.
Yeah, he had an attitude, a swagger. In many respects, he used to remind me now, he resembled Keith Richards a little bit. I could
that
never,
sounds a little scary to me.
Well, a young Keith Richards. Well, Keith's always been a bit scary, but
as a father figure, anyway.
Yeah, Dad loved Cab Calloway and jazz music, and as I say, played banjo, so that's where the strumming style guitar I've got comes from.
Weren't the Kinks part of the so-called British invasion? What was America like to you at the time of the Kinks' first U.S. tour in the mid-60s?
Well, the Kinks were always an odd bunch, even for the Brits. First record you really got me sounded like nothing else on the radio. The follow-up, All Day and All the Night, Tired of Waiting for You, was a more conventional song. But we came to America on the wave of that. Well, the first words I heard from the immigration officer when I came through immigration was, "Are you a Beatle or are you a girl?" And I said...
Because she had long hair.
Yeah, and I said, "I'm a girl and so is my brother." So we didn't just kick off very well. And the tour itself, although the audience were fantastic and we played in front of sometimes 15,000 people, organization was abysmal and we fell out with various people on tour. And it ended up getting banned from America for 4 years.
Well, I'll ask you about that in a moment. But I'm wondering about the first show that you played in New York. Wasn't that at the Academy of Music?
The Academy of Music, which became...
Was that a Murray the K show?
The Palladium later on, I think on 14th Street, yeah. Somewhere like that. Or as we learned to call it, the Quaaludium. Palladium and the promoter, I forget his name now, he came on, and these guys from London, please welcome the Kinks. And we went on and played. It was a fantastic show, but I think there was because of the name, the Kinks, and because of the way we looked, red hunting jackets, we also didn't have a very organized publicity team around us. So we were thrown in. My brother was barely 17 when we first came over, so we were rookies in the purest sense.
And people were expecting the Beatles.
The Fab Four, as we called them, were so well organized. You know, they had a great PR man, a great manager. And I think there was a fear among American popular music at that time that the Brits would... We were called the invaders, you know. And there was an element of that. We were like creatures from the Black Lagoon coming to invade America.
But you also didn't have anybody who was known for being a great individual player.
Within the band?
Yeah.
Well, that's the secret of bands. I was talking to someone yesterday about I'm doing a record based on the book. And we were talking about musicians. The thing about the Kinks, and I think many other bands, and even the Beatles, were never great virtuoso individual players, but as a unit, they gelled and worked really well together.
I'm sure you know many Kinks songs, and now I'm speaking with the band's songwriter and lead singer, Ray Davis. He's written a memoir called Americana. I assume that there were also some serious tensions. There are in pretty much every band that's thrown together. Did it make it any easier or more difficult that one of the members was your brother?
Not specifically. You see, I didn't have a conventional relationship with my brother. I lived with my older sister for my early teens for various reasons. So I never had a conventional relationship with my brother Dave until we went on tour. And there was friction between my brother and the drummer, Mick. And a few weeks before the American tour, Mick and Dave had a terrible fight on stage and the police were called to arrest Mick for attempted murder.
With a drumstick?
No, with a hi-hat, which it resulted in Dave getting about 12, 15 stitches in his head. The police had wanted to arrest him and he said, well, it was an accident. And they said, we had 5,000 witnesses in the audience. So eventually that was resolved. But this was only weeks before we embarked on the tour. So tensions were high, emotions were high. And I think it resulted, as I say, in this disastrous tour and ending up in a union ban.
And then you said the Kinks were banned from playing in the United States after that tour was over, a ban that lasted from 65 to 69. What had you done?
in the book, I try to rationalize it. I'm flattered you call it a memoir. I think it's more like I'm trying to memoir.
There are newspaper articles and other things that you could have gone back to refresh your memory.
These things, I listened to the music when I did another book called X-Ray, and I didn't research myself. I played the music, and the music is very, it's like an inner documentary of my life, and I can remember when I wrote a certain song. Victoria, for example, I remember where I lived, the piano I had, I wrote it on. And I had my daughter was born while I was writing the song. Of course, she was called Victoria, after my work. So it is my research, is my music, because, again, I say in the book, it's like I have a musical diary I take around with me in my head. I think of theme songs every day, because I came to music late. I studied as an art student. Painting, and it taught me to observe people, and I carried on those same observations into my music. So You Really Got Me was the first hit we had, and it was about the fifth song I ever wrote. Of course, when it goes to number one, everybody thinks I know how to do it, but I had no life experience to write about. So I used my art school training and wrote about characters.
And you kind of made up stories for these songs.
Yeah, I think
they all seem to tell a story.
They tell a story because I think that goes back to my English teacher at school. I just did an article in the London paper about inspirational teachers, and my art school teacher was very, very concerned that I got into the art school and pursued my career as a creative person.
Did you go to art school?
Yeah.
Which one?
I went to Hornsey Art School. And I was applying to, after it was a 5-year course, after the second year I was applying to go to a place called The Central, which did theatre as well as art. But in between that time, I got in a band.
And that was that. And you very cleverly avoided answering the question about why you were banned from the United States.
I think the best way to explain it really is my drummer, Mick Avery. It was a mixture of bad management, bad luck and bad behavior. And of course, America was very conservative then, and British sense of humor was not, it was alien, really.
Although we were getting less conservative, because you weren't here, you missed Woodstock.
They did us a favor in that respect.
Monterey, some of the other big festivals. That probably lost you some audience. Or were you still selling records here?
We were making records and having careers. I wrote songs like Waterloo Sunset, Victoria, just played Days, Sunny Afternoon, had or Village Green Preservation Society, while we had no future. There's no way we could get to America. So I think when we came back, we found we had to start from scratch playing small clubs, and we played at the Fillmore, but like more or less an opening act. So our status has dropped, because remember, there was no satellite radio, MTV, and if you didn't perform here and get on a few of the big shows like Hullabaloo and Dick Clark, which we never did, you didn't have access to an American audience, so we lost a little bit of leeway.
You said that the Kinks, the name, the Kinks, might have been a problem. Is that why you think you didn't get on shows like Dick Clark and Hullabaloo? Because you were a pretty big band.
Oh, we were. We
where did the name the Kinks come from?
Well, it's not very glamorous.
Are you trying to tell us something?
We were in a bar. We wore outrageous leather capes and leather hats, and my brother had thigh-length leather boots on. And we were pondering over what to call ourselves, and there was a drunk sitting on a bar stool at the end of the bar, and he said, "You should be called Kinks." And then he fell off his bar stool. So I thank that man. If ever you're around, I'd like to thank you.
Ray Davis is my guest. He is the rock singer-songwriter who's inspired a generation of musicians, from The Who, The Clash, and The Ramones to Black Sabbath, as the lead singer and songwriter for The Kinks. He has written, you say I shouldn't call it a memoir, I don't know. It is the closest thing to a memoir I can't think of another word. Anyway, it's called Americana, The Kinks, The Riff, The Road, The Story. It's published by Sterling, and we will continue our conversation after we take a little break. Stay with us.
No money coming in.
Manifesting itself, and you cry out loud, and nobody can help. And it's a one-way sign to the gates of hell, and there's no way back. No, there's no way back. Ain't no wonder you can't sleep at night. You just heard the voodoo call. So you pace around to the zombie crawl, and you shuffle around in your prison cell, doing the voodoo walk, dancing with yourself. And you just can't blame the zombie inside of you, all the voodoo curse hanging over you, all the zombie walk like a notes off shoe, with a voodoo man's talking inside of you, doing the voodoo walk, voodoo walk.
Didn't you write this song after the incident that you start this book with?
I was writing it during that time, yeah.
It was a life-changing event when you were shot during a botched robbery in New Orleans.
Yeah, it was a ridiculous behavior on my part. You should never chase a man with a gun. Which, you know, it's flight or fright, I think that's what they call it, and I chose to fight. You never know until you actually experience something like that, and it was nearly a tragic end.
I'm speaking with Ray Davis, his latest book. This is your second book?
Yeah.
It's called Americana, The Kinks, The Riff, The Road, The Story. It is published by Sterling. So you wound up in the hospital, and you were identified as unknown purple on your wristband.
Yeah.
Did you know what was happening?
No. Well, I wasn't on tour. I'd been to New Orleans before as part of the band, but you never really see the city. You go from the airport to the hotel, sound check, then leave the next day. But I was trying to find a place to center my creativity in New Orleans. And like I said at the beginning of this interview, the music that inspired me was blues, R&B, Cajun, country. So I was going back to what I thought was the source of American music. And in the book, I describe how I toured America just after 2001, 9/11. After 9/11, and I discovered that really America inspired me came from the South. I was in New Orleans. I was actually trying to start a music program with a young marching band in the school, public school next door to where I was staying.
So there you were in the hospital.
Yeah.
And a chaplain.
I wasn't Ray Davis anymore. I was somebody called Unknown Purple, which is a way of identifying bodies that come into the hospital.
Because you had a wristband that was purple.
Yeah.
How come they didn't know who you were?
I'm not a very memorable person.
Oh, come on.
No, I mean, because with my songs, I'm not like, say, Mick Jagger. Mick is always Jumping Jack Flash, instantly identifiable. But my songs are like stories, as you said. And I'm like an actor adopting a character when I do my music. So
do you like being someone else?
It helps sometimes, but somehow I've learned over the years to always explained who I am within the song, but I adopt different personas.
When the doctor finally told you that it was time for you to go home, you asked yourself, where is that?
Yeah, I think it's to do, I think at that time I was looking for my identity. You know, it's been on the road since I was 18 years old, since I just left college, and looking for a place to settle down, really.
And you've said that touring has become what you call a haphazard quest for a sense of being and belonging.
Yes, well.
So you never felt comfortable wherever you were?
I never settled anywhere. In fact, doing this book, finishing it off since the end of last year, it's the longest I've spent in London since I first went on the road. So I've always been traveling, seemingly, living in suitcases.
That experience in New Orleans wasn't the first time that you had problems with your identity. Weren't you arrested for impersonating Ray Davis back in 1980?
Yeah, I just like to qualify something I just said, living out of suitcases rather than in them.
I just assume you have very large suitcases.
Yeah. I had a trombone player once who used to carry a cooker in his suitcase so he could save on room service. Anyway, that's another story. But yeah, I was flying from Vancouver to Portland, Oregon, so it's the Canadian border, and a policeman came on the airplane when we landed and said, "Is Ray Davis on board?" And I put my hand up and he cuffed me immediately. And they took me into custody for 2 or 3 hours in immigration. And they finally realized I was not Ray Davis, who they thought was... He got my autograph in somewhere in California and was forging checks, so they let me go for the concert.
They thought you were the forger.
They thought I was the guy impersonating me, which is fairly standard in my life.
Now, you've talked about how important the United States has been to you, but there are people who say your songs are about your Englishness. Do you agree with that?
Well, my answer to that is... known as a quintessentially English songwriter. I write about characters, well-respected men, dedicated followers of fashion, the broken-down aristocrat in sunny afternoon. But I write about characters, and that's what I was doing in America, in New Orleans particularly. The characters there, as in New York, when I lived in New York.
How long did you live here? Because a number of British rock stars have lived here, but they've stayed here.
Yeah, I'm a renter. I'm not a permanent liver. But I on and off for about 8 years when I was signed to Arista Records, and we were on the Upper West Side at that time. So it was a good way to keep synergy and unified sort of presence with the record company.
You, one of the pervasive themes in this book is how homesick you become wherever you go. So no matter where you are, no matter how happy you are, London is always calling you back?
My relationship with London is a confusing one. I love the North London because of the height. It's the highest part of London where I live, and something about people who live on hills. And I'm a wanderer, and the River Thames is important to me for various reasons. Certain landmark events in my life have taken place by the Thames, and I've written a song called Waterloo Sunset, which reflects that feeling. But Londoner, well, like so many Londoners now, we're questioning what's happening to the city. It's new buildings. Like New York, there's construction everywhere. They're changing. And London doesn't really have the infrastructure for that. It's built for the horse and cart. And it's got all these narrow... Good thing about New York, it's a grid system, and you can construct it and rebuild it. But London's got all these difficult turnings and unknown streets.
And when a bus is going down one of those narrow streets, no
buses.
Other cars can go.
These new buses are a nightmare.
But you've also written that you sometimes feel politically estranged from the New Britain.
In the book, I go into some detail about that. Britpop was a musical movement that cited the Kinks as one of the inspiring bands. And I think when New Labour came in, I was a socialist when I was growing up. My father was a socialist, not radical, but lent to the left.
Well, Labour Party was connected to the international socialist movement.
Yeah, and which didn't go down too well on our first American tour. I was actually called a commie red, but just for being a socialist. But when New Labour came in with Tony Blair, it was a different slant. as I think even Blair had been a member of the Conservative Party at some point. So it was a new PR. It was a great PR exercise. And it reflected itself in the music. Great new bands like Blur, Pulp were emerging. But I felt a sense of estrangement from England. That's why I wanted to discover the music that inspired me in America when I ended up in New Orleans.
Well, you mentioned that you signed with Arista. How did Clive Davis convince you to sign a deal with him? Because he was, the kind of music that he was recording was quite different from what you do.
It was, Clive was more, and still is, more middle of the road than the Kinks.
Well, he also has done Aretha Franklin and some pretty great artists.
Yeah, no,
Whitney Houston.
But he understood my characters within my song, the sensibility, whereas other corporations, you know, they don't really value that sort of writing. And Clive, we struck up a relationship and a communication. And I used to take my new song when I stayed here down to his office on then 57th Street, and we used to exchange ideas. And it was a wonderful interaction with Clive.
In retrospect, was that a good move for you?
It was the only move I think I could have made at that point, because we'd been with a big corporation, RCA, who allowed us total artistic freedom. And the records, Preservation, Soap Opera, Schoolboys in Disgrace, Muscle Hillbillies, were all artistic successes, but not commercial in any respect. But some tracks have endured, like Celluloid Heroes, 20th Century Man, from that period. So it was a different arc. We were aiming to get in the top 40 charts.
Well, hadn't you started that way? When the band began, you were just doing singles and hoping to get in the top 40 charts.
Yeah.
There's a weird thing. You start off doing that, and then you end up doing that.
I think when I first started writing, as I said, it really got me was the fourth, fifth song I ever wrote. People think you can do it because you write a number one. And I didn't know how to write songs. I still don't. It's make it up as you go along. You know, when I do songwriting seminars, I do one every year, first thing I say is I can't teach you to write songs. I can help you with construction and help you be creative. But creativity is an incredible gift. You either, and it has to be worked at. But so I had that string of singles in the 60s, all about 14, 15 hits in a row. Then I wanted to embrace a larger landscape with my records, hence things thematically like Muswell Hillbillies, which is about urban redevelopment. It's very un-rock and roll, but it worked for me. And Soap Opera was a musical parody of a soap opera. I watched a show in America, I think it was called The Edge of Night. I don't know if it's still on anymore. But I wrote, I set that sort of story to music, and it was hilarious.
Well, you often take other personas when you're writing a song. But one of the distinctive things about your songs that they have these very catchy hooks or riffs. Mm. Do you start off with that, or do you start off with a story idea and then find ways of telling it?
In Americana, I say that wherever I go, I hope to find a good riff there. To me, riff is a substitute for life. Without a good riff and pulse, it's a pulse, not strictly a musical riff, something to stick under the music to remind you you're alive, almost. So I like writing from riffs. And then occasionally, people have said to me, what's it like, difference between writing a book and writing a song? Some of my songs, 20th Century Man from Muswell Hillbillies, started off as a 30-page outline for a story about someone who was being, his house was being demolished. So sometimes I write that way to actually break down the story elements, and then I edit it down into a song.
Well, since you're a wanderer, how does where you write your songs affect them?
I usually write on scraps of paper. Yeah. I found, for the book, I found an old diary I had in 1977. It was the first year we were with Arista, so I kept this very strict diary, and that makes quite interesting reading in the book.
Well, you've written the book as a kind of stream of consciousness series of memories, also a kind of road trip of your life. Did that approach come easily to you?
The structure of the book was a concern to begin with, because I start when I'm in the hospital recovering from gunshot wounds, and then I use a flashback device, almost a cinematic approach, because one of the doctors in the hospital in trauma room said he wrote scripts for a hobby. He said, you could see that I was very distressed by what was happening. He said, you're a writer, just write down your thoughts here. And it got me through it. And I wrote many songs in the hospital and kept quite a tight script diary of the events.
In the epilogue, you write that songs are like friends who comfort you so you don't feel alone.
Yeah.
Which reminds me of one of your songs, People Take Pictures of Each Other, just to prove that they really existed.
Mm. I think they do tend to... songs can be therapeutic, certainly. For example, one of my most light-hearted songs, Dedicated Follower of Fashion, which was a send-up of fashion-conscious people, was written after a brawl with a fashion designer who accused me of wearing flares. So that was a terrible argument, and I sat down, wanted to write something angry, and decided to write something frivolous and funny, because that's the best form of, attack, counterattack.
And you often write funny. You have had some great successes. You were inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in 1990, and then 2004 you were made a Commander of the Order of the British Empire. I don't know if that means I have to call you Sir Davis, but... another big deal, 2012, your performance of the King's song Waterloo Sunset was a highlight of the closing ceremonies of the London Olympics.
Yeah, that was.
Are you feeling accepted finally?
No, I think I've never felt accepted, and I think if I did, I'd be complacent. I think I'm not a very complacent person. I move on to the next. The only thing that keeps me motivated and going is the next song. And I'm writing, as I say, there are many new songs quoted in the book, Americana, and I'm writing a title song now for the album of the book. So that's what keeps the passion going and keeps me motivated.
Well, your last CD was See My Friends, in which you collaborated with Bruce Springsteen, Metallica, John Bon Jovi, not exactly a group that I would say is having much in common. Do you feel connections to all of them?
Well, the amazing thing was all those bands, Metallica chose to collaborate on You Really Got Me, which was a no-brainer, actually. Mm-hmm. And they did a great job. And Bruce picked a song that was hardly ever heard of before. I think it was a minor hit in America called Better Things. And I went down to his ranch in New Jersey and recorded with him. I was producing the record, and it was quite a thing to say to him, yeah, can you do that one more time, Bruce? You know, can you do it this way, do it that way? So there was an element of really camaraderie within the recording. And Bon Jovi really wanted to sing this song, Celluloid Heroes. And it's very un-Bon Jovi, so they're very generous with their time and their efforts.
Tell us about the song, The Getaway, which is the last one you mixed for the album Other People's Lives. Are you still making your getaway?
It's a song I wrote in New Orleans when I first went to stay there. And it was about, because I stayed in the Marigny area and you could hear the freight trains coming in. And like I said at the beginning of this interview, my family are from the inner city of the King's Cross Railway. And it's a theme that's really gone through my life, the railroad system. And The Getaway is about someone who's making a decision to actually go. And it's a goodbye song. But I'm not sure what it's goodbye to.
Well, we're going to go out with it, our way of saying goodbye. But I want to tell our listeners that Ray Davis will be speaking and signing books at the Union Square Barnes & Noble store tomorrow night at 7 o'clock. The book, Americana, The Kinks, The Riff, The Road, The Story, published by Sterling. Thank you so much for being with us again.
It's great for having me here.
Every time